Yeah, welcome to JavaScript Jam.
Yeah!
We're going to have some fun today, but I'm not going to get into that just yet.
No fun yet. The fun will come.
We're going to be boring.
You got to wait for
2 seconds. You got to have some fun, folks. We're here at Render ATL, having a great time. We're out here looking up over the city out of our hotel room, and we're having a really awesome setup here. I'm really excited about it, and we have someone really cool sitting on the couch over here next to me. His name is...
What's his name?
Ryan
Magoon.
Thank you.
Ryan
Magoon in the house.
More and more tortured.
Dude, I'm just trying to drag it out because I'm ready to get going. All right, let's do it. So, my name is Scott Starling. I'm technical community manager at Edgio, and you are?
Developer advocate at Edgio.
All right.
Okay.
Who are you?
I'm a senior staff engineer at PayPal working on checkout.
Yes. Ryan Magoon. Awesome, brother.
Checkout. I hear that's the important part.
Yeah. Well, it makes the most money.
Makes the only money.
Yeah.
There's no checkout. There's literally no money.
Yeah.
That's true. Can't happen if you can't swipe the card or type it in.
How long have you been at PayPal for?
6 months.
6 months? Cool.
Yeah.
What inspired you to work for PayPal?
Well, I was like a senior engineer, so I was a tech lead at Advanced Auto Parts, working on their e-commerce, starting in React Native, and then ending up rewriting their whole front end in Next.js. And then PayPal reached out to me, and they're interested in some of that work I did, bring it over there. The interesting part was that it was a senior IC role. So I was actually engineering manager the last year at Advance. Yeah, I got the opportunity to like try my hand at like being staff plus engineer. I was like, oh, okay, let me go try this. Like kind of getting all the infinity stones for like all the roles.
Well, this is great because we talked to a lot of DevRel people, a lot of developer advocates, some people who were engineers and moved to DevRel, some people who only did DevRel. But I feel like it's not as often we just get to talk to people who are like in the guts of engineering or just like slinging code. So, yeah, it'd be great to talk to you about some of that. So, yeah, why don't you give a little bit of, like, your background and how you got into code? I think that's always interesting to learn a little bit about, like, what inspired you to even learn to code in the first place.
Okay. From a really young age, my dad was, like, a huge computer nerd. So I'd always have, like, Linux around the house. Not really coding so much, just using it for different stuff, like playing video games, doing other stuff. One of the punishments he would give me is, like, we had a TRS-80 in the house. And, like, sometimes he would make me read a letter out of the encyclopedia, like, the whole letter. But sometimes he would give me one of these books with, like, all these basic code in it. And he would, like, make me write out a whole program. And then if it didn't work, he would make me rewrite it. It's like
the weird form of education / child abuse.
Yeah. So I actually didn't like programming that much because like I associated it.
That's hilarious.
We all go back to our roots.
Yeah. Awesome. So when I started college, I was doing mechanical aerospace engineering, and like I had some anxiety problems back then, like learning disability stuff. So I was like in and out of school. But in between that, my mom was friends with this guy working at a startup on the side. And he reached out to me, Jamie Dixon, actually, like really big in the .NET community. And he sat me down and he was like, yeah, you should go talk to him because like you really need to like get a job. And so I talked to him and he like gave me code complete. And he's like, go read this. And then I showed up and he's like, OK, write a C# class. And I did it. He's like, OK, you're hired. And then that's how I got started, like at the internship over there. It was called Lobby Guard. So that was a pretty interesting place.
And then how'd you find your way to this whole React front-end world from C#?
Yeah, so, like, back then, they were pushing me towards, like, CI/CD, which is actually really great. I was, like, part of the .NET user group. They were taking me to meetups, and I was meeting all these people. Scott Hanselman, actually. Like, I ran into him a long time ago.
Gee.
Yeah, in, like, 2012.
He's here, actually. I think I saw him.
Yeah, I'll have to reach out to him. It was interesting, because I just hated .NET. But, like, I kind of cut my teeth back then, like, helping people move from TFS to Git. And that's when Azure was first being a thing. And so I was doing that stuff. And it was really valuable to people. But I just was not into it. And so I wasn't progressing that much because I wasn't really putting the time in to get good at it.
I'd be passionate, bro.
Yeah. And then ES 2015 came out. And I was, like, on Code School. And I messed with it a little bit. And I was like, wow, this is actually so fun. Because, like, being on Windows and being a like Visual Studio was just so overwhelming. The amount of work you have to do just to like get a hello world, I felt like it was so complicated. And yeah, just being in the browser, your iteration cycle of like code to result is just so fast.
Yeah, JavaScript is actually fun.
It was addicting. Yeah, yeah. And then once like the new versions of JavaScript came out, it was actually like super fun. But I actually, most of the programming I was doing back then was on React Native when I started working with it.
So that would have been pretty early then in React Native's life cycle.
Yeah, 2016.
That's when there were migrations happening. There were some migrations that got unmigrated. Like Airbnb was a famous example of that. And people were like, ooh, is React Native going to be a thing or not? And you know, obviously it's still a thing and probably bigger than ever. Do you still do any React Native?
Not really. Yeah, so I had a side project called Find My Spot, which was a app that would let you rent out your driveway for the day if you have a beach house.
Oh, dope.
Smart.
Do you guys remember that pool app that came out, Rent Your Pool Out, during like 2020? when COVID happened.
I never
had
a pool, so.
All the pools shut down, and this company did something very similar.
Come use my pool and give me COVID.
Sounds yeah, like an insurance
like Airbnb,
nightmare.
But for your pool. Yeah, right? And they had insurance in the app, just like Airbnb or Uber or stuff like that. But yeah, it's very similar. And they have that for actually people's garages now. You can rent out someone's garage if they'll offer you one space. If you have like a boat or a car or something like that, you don't want to put it in storage, you use someone's garage at their place. It's kind of cool. Similar thing. It's neat.
Yeah.
So, hey, it actually took off in many different places.
I stopped using it right before it got good. Like Expo was horrible back then. It was just a toy. Like it was cool, but it just you couldn't build a production app with it. Really, you would have to eject. You would there was always some library you needed.
And to dig on that for people who aren't into this world, what you're saying is that you could use it to write very basic things, but as soon as you want to do something actually on the phone that is like a phone native thing, like use the gyroscope or something, you have these native APIs that are written in like Swift or something.
Yeah, so part of it is using those native modules. The other part of it is actually like building and shipping the app to the App Store. Mm. Expo was handling both of those things. Okay. So it was just really hard to be proficient without you pretty much had to know some Objective-C and Java.
Right, that's what it was before Swift, Objective-C, yeah.
Yeah, because most of the stuff you're using, like React Native Maps, which Airbnb had open source, but like below that was Objective-C. So like one of the things we had to do at Map My Customers, which is where I ended up going, was like put heat maps in the map, and you just had to, if they wouldn't accept your PR, you would have to modify it yourself and then inject it, and it's just like a whole mess.
So what's the biggest difference between doing React Native and React Proper?
Well, I think debugging is harder in React Native because you don't have URLs. So if you have deeply nested workflows, like you can't just like jump to something. Nowadays you kind of can, but back then you definitely couldn't. It was way harder to debug. So like wrapping your head around how that works, you have like stack navigations and things like that, tab navigations. But thinking about like how you orient yourself around the app and do routing is probably the biggest difference. Styling is very similar and the code is almost all the same logic wise.
Yeah, I've always wanted to, because I've never written like a single line of React Native, but I'm doing React for years and years and years. So I've always been like, you know, I could learn React Native. I could probably ship like a very rudimentary app, but just like I've never really like taken that dive in. So it's always a world that I'm like very curious to learn more about, even though I don't really know anything about it.
Yeah, so that's why I brought it up, because I think the two big innovations were like Expo now is actually amazing and you don't have to eject from it. So all the pain.
That's what I've heard. I've heard Expo's incredible from people who use it. So it sounds like they really pulled it together.
Yeah. All the pain I was describing about having to pull in things or like worry about upgrades or dealing with the app stores, that's almost completely abstracted. And it's really, really amazing. So like, as a solo dev, it's actually pretty feasible to ship quickly with that now. That and TypeScript not sucking, I think, makes React Native dev just way, way better.
Well, once we ship the Astro JavaScript Jam front page, yeah, we'll ship a JavaScript Jam app to the App Store.
That would be fun.
Yeah.
Very cool. One of the things that you are really big into and seem to know a decent amount about and have worked a lot on is accessibility. So I would love to pivot and talk a little bit about that. Why is accessibility a topic that you're passionate about? It's kind of a weird question, because like ideally everyone should be passionate about it, but it's unfortunately not the case.
Yeah, so disability is part of my identity because I grew up in a deaf family. So my parents were like 18 when I was born. So a lot of my like really early life was being raised by my grandparents who are both deaf. So ASL is my first language. Growing up in the deaf community and having grandparents like that, and actually like relying on people with like profound disabilities, really opens your eyes to a lot of like how the world works for those people, how they get things done.
So it's hard until you see it through their experience. It's like everything just works for us. So why doesn't everything work for everybody? And it's like, well, a lot of reasons.
Yeah. So from that perspective, it's always been around. I've always been around like deaf people and blind people. My partner is also visually impaired, like has a guide dog, and she's also she does a lot of stuff. She's a lawyer and she like writes books and stuff. And so I've also been around like really high achieving people with disabilities and kind of seen people using assistive tech in all kinds of different contexts. I wouldn't say like I'm super skilled at accessibility in terms of like working on it, but I would say from first principles,
there's different ways to kind of think about it, because there's being able to think of it from the user perspective, like what is the specific disabilities that we need to account for and what are the technologies they're using? What is it actually like for them to use these technologies? Then what is it like having to code for those technologies? And I find that what you're saying, having the first principles thinking, that can be really the hardest, because anyone can learn an API, you know, but not everyone can live in someone else's shoes.
Definitely. That's actually kind of the big hypothesis behind the talk I did at React Miami.
Awesome. Talk about that.
Yeah. So it was titled Building for Disabled Power Users. And basically the point of it was, first off, like the overlap between disabled users and like what you would think of as a power user in terms of somebody who uses lots of special features of the app to improve their efficiency, to make their workflow better. And also, like, if you break those workflows, it's very bad and they'll probably leave. But they're also the most passionate users. If they get good at a tool, they'll probably stick with it. As long as that's the best way to do it, they'll probably be the ones writing reviews and advocating and bringing people
term
with them.
I like that term you use, power user, because this is something I have a good friend, Ben Myers, who's one of the best accessibility experts I know. And what he'll say is that everyone who uses assistive technology and needs to use it becomes a power user by necessity. Like, they have to learn the ins and outs of that tech because it's their window into the world.
Yeah, exactly. If you've ever seen a professional or really anybody proficient with a screen reader or like a braille display or anything like that, it's like, I don't know if you've ever hung out with like somebody like the Primogen or somebody who's just like wicked good, like they're using Tmux and all this stuff and Vim, and you're like, oh my gosh, how are they doing
this?
They
do 10 things by the time it takes you to ask a question about the first thing they did.
500 keyboard shortcuts.
Yeah,
exactly. And I think most people see disabled users through like this infantilized lens of like a person who can't do much. They're fumbling, fumbling through life, probably doesn't have a real job, probably is not in a hurry. And that's like a big problem.
Yeah, I'd be like far more sophisticated at this tech than you could even imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. A big part of being competent in accessibility at all isn't really looking at a WCAG checklist of like basic, like, can I tap through this website at all?
WCAG is very quickly.
Yeah, Web Content Accessibility Guidelines. So that is like basically what the Americans with Disabilities Act says you have to do at a minimum for your website to be considered accessible for like legal reasons.
And it's a spec. It's like a W3C spec that is not particularly user-friendly to read.
No. It's very verbose, but there's different levels. There's like A, AA, and AAA. AA is the minimum you need to meet, and then contextually you'd want to hit AAA, especially if it's like pertinent to the workflows in your app. But the big problem is like none of that ensures usability. And a lot of it is oriented around
a checklist, but a checklist doesn't get back to the lived experience of the users.
Exactly. One of my favorite articles I've seen are the guys who like make an 100 Lighthouse score app that is like completely
slow.
Either really slow or completely inaccessible.
Nice. Yeah. Deshaun would love that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. We can probably link that in like the show notes or something. We'll do. Accessibility doesn't ensure usability. That's really the big thing of why cultivating empathy and actually like you either need to work with disabled people, have them in leadership, you need to go out and meet them. There's plenty of like YouTube people you can watch to get an idea for like what these people are doing and how they live.
Well, I mean, you know, UX, so as part of like a UX job, right, part of it is to interview your user base, right? And it's like, then you need to make it your mission to make sure you find those users who have the disabilities as well to create accessibility for them, right? And go out and interview them appropriately as you've interviewed everybody else, right? I mean, like, can't leave it out. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's the same and it has the same downfalls. But the consequences are usually really severe. It's the same reason, like, if you're making a dating app and you don't include women in the product development, you might you might do some really sketchy stuff.
Sure.
And create some bad problems. Yeah. So, yeah, it's exactly like that.
You said how you'd also worked on things like compliance and the legal aspect. So when you actually were at a company having to work on these types of issues, what were some of the things that came up and that you had to fix and work on?
Well, there's like classes of things. The most basic thing you can do is just like hit tab a bunch of times and see if it makes sense. Like, can you tell where the focus is going? And that is not a perfect representation of what a screen reader is going to be like, but it can definitely give you clues as to like what problems you're going to run into. That'd be the first thing I do. Like, does it make sense? Or does...
Same thing Ben will tell you to do.
So, yeah.
You know how there's like mobile emulation? Mm-hmm. Is there like screen reading emulation so you can develop better for it?
Yeah, you talk about JAWS and things like that.
Well, JAWS is a screen reader, right. Like for Windows. True.
That's not an emulator. So I guess, is there a point to use an emulator versus just use an actual screen reader?
Right. Yeah.
I would say no. It's good to visualize the accessibility tree, and for like automated testing, that's very useful.
Should also explain the accessibility tree. At least what it is. I need to go super deep.
I'm not like super technically aware of this, but it's kind of like the DOM, but it's what a screen reader or other assistive tech could see in terms of like what is accessible.
So it breaks down. Yeah, it breaks down the headers, it breaks down the links, it breaks down the inputs, and then that's what the screen reader is going to read out to the user.
Yeah, so like what is going to be in the DOM that's not in the accessibility tree is like random divs. Like stuff like that isn't going to show up.
Yeah, it takes all that div soup out for you.
Yeah, but paragraphs will be in there, headings, buttons, links, things like that.
What are things that if someone knows absolutely nothing about accessibility, what are some tools that you would recommend they start learning and becoming proficient with?
One thing is in Chrome DevTools, since 2020, I believe, you can have colorblindness simulation as well as low vision simulation. So that's really useful. It used to be you had to get a Chrome plugin for that. Now you can pop up DevTools and it's right there.
This is for color contrast, because for some people, certain colors, it'll be really hard to actually read the text because it's against the background and it just all blurs together.
Like red would be a terrible background.
Yeah, but it also simulates every type of color blindness.
Oh, really?
So that's really useful. Yeah, yeah. So you can test on the fly, you can like test out some designs and stuff like that. Cool. That's stuff that you probably already have. You don't have to download anything. That's really useful. But then I would also say, like, if you're in product at all, like if you're a product person or a designer or a developer, you probably need to learn how to use a screen reader. It doesn't really matter which one. Probably one on desktop and one on mobile, because you just need to understand how it works. There's no other way to cultivate empathy and like have a clue about what's going to be a good or a bad design unless you've actually experienced that.
Is there a specific one you'd recommend?
It depends on what you work on. So VoiceOver is the one on Mac. So if you're on a Mac, definitely just learn that.
Then the Windows one is JAWS. I think that's the most used one.
JAWS
type percentage.
JAWS costs money. It's like half JAWS and half NVDA. NVDA is the other one. And then I believe on Android, it's called TalkBack.
That's interesting. I've never thought about the fact that there would be a different screen reader for desktop versus mobile. What are some of the differences that come up between the two?
On mobile, you don't have any buttons, so it's way different. I know in VoiceOver, there's this thing called the rotor. Kind of like in Vim, you have these different input modalities. You move the input rotor in like VoiceOver, and it allows you to like go from navigating to like input. For people with profound blindness, I know there's input modes where people can like flip the rotor and they can flip their like iPad or phone backwards and then use three fingers on each side to type out Braille.
Oh, really?
Like they're punching out messages.
Wow.
Yeah, because it's like if you think about it, how would you use a keyboard if you're completely blind on a touchscreen? Yeah, there's videos of this on YouTube. Trying to think. I believe Molly Burke is the name of one person who uses it. There's some people I can link to you. It's really cool stuff though.
So you can create a case that an iPad goes into that has Braille keyboard on the back.
Well, it's actually the same layout as a Braille typewriter. Yeah, so it just knows where your fingers are to use three fingers on each side. But like, it's kind of like if you've seen
Scott or I've ever seen a Braille keyboard before.
No. It's really interesting. It's kind of like those things that like court reporters use, but
yeah,
it's a little different.
Stenographer.
Yeah. Let's make sure I was thinking of the right thing. But yeah, it's only a few buttons, and you type out like the Braille cells. Okay. And so you each time you press it down, it like does a cell. So three on each side, and you just you like press the combination. There's like contractions in Braille, and all kinds of other things. It's pretty cool.
Huh.
Yeah, I find accessibility, it is such a actually like very deep technical topic. And if you're someone who nerds out on that kind of stuff, you can go very deep into it. And I think it's a shame that a lot of people think of it as this like weird kind of niche specialty that they don't really ever even think about or dive into. Because it's like the times I've had accessibility conversations and have had to work on accessibility issues in apps that I've worked on, it's always been like, well, that's actually a really interesting technical challenge. And then you get that boost of like, this is having real impact for real people also.
Totally. That's awesome.
Yes. Yeah.
Cool. Is there anything else you want to hit on in the accessibility realm?
One of the apps that I was looking up when I was doing my talk that I was particularly impressed by was VS Code. It has so many cool accessibility features.
Really? Speak on that. I don't know of any of them, actually.
I think one of my favorite ones that I think regular devs could use was the sound cues. There's actually an entire API for sound cues that tell you when something happened in the editor. You know, sometimes you'll be typing and like you're in TypeScript or like your linter will like put a red squiggly somewhere else in the file.
Yeah.
But like if you're blind, how would you know that that happened?
Yeah.
So it'll be like bloop. Like,
oh, that's so cool.
Or like shh. Like there'll be like different sounds depending on like what kind of event just happened, or like if you hit a breakpoint, or if something in the terminal just finished.
Yeah.
And like, was it exit one? Was it exit zero? Like what just happened? So it's first class.
What are some other topics you want to talk about?
I don't know.
Open the floor. What's your favorite video game?
Just beat Tears of the Kingdom.
I have no idea what that is.
The new Zelda game.
Oh, gotcha. Oh, ooh, yeah. I love Zelda. I played crazy mad video games from age like 4 to 18, then became obsessed with music, and then became obsessed with coding. And so I haven't really gamed in like 10 years. But Ocarina of Time is my favorite game of all time.
Really?
Yeah.
Link to the Past is my favorite Zelda game.
Right on.
My favorite game of all time is really tough. I think it would be Grim Fandango.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Yeah. It's just dripping in style.
Yeah.
I love the old point and click stuff. Also, like, kind of a weird throwback, Snatcher. It's like this Hideo Kojima game before he made Metal Gear Solid.
Ooh.
It's a visual novel. It's kind of like Blade Runner. It's really cool. It came out in the 80s, but they remade it for Sega CD. And it's like the best soundtrack. It's a super cool murder mystery.
What was the game thing he put out that was like a survivalist game that came out a little while ago?
Death Stranding?
Yeah. You played that one?
Yeah. It's cool. If you're into like art house movies, it's very much like that.
Yeah, well, my best friends from college was like obsessed with Hideo Kojima.
Yeah. It's like super weird. It's like, what if like A24 made a video game? Yeah, it's out there.
Watch Beef.
I haven't, not yet.
It's an A24 TV show. It's really, really good.
That's cool.
What's your favorite video game, Scott?
That's a hard question. I haven't played video games in quite some time, actually. Since I've had kids, pretty much. I haven't had time.
Well, then pre that, what was your favorite video game before you had kids and became lame?
I mean, kids are like pretty much a video game. You know, you gotta play with them all the time, so.
They go up 1 point every year.
I'd say, it's so hard, honestly. I can't put my finger on anything.
What were some games you loved as a kid?
Yeah.
Okay, what game consoles did you have?
I know. So we had like PS2, PS1, Sega Genesis, and then I had friends who had like N64 and regular Nintendo as well. And you know, so we played all those games. You know, played Perfect Dark, played Smash Brothers. You know. Played all kinds of different things.
That's what we need. We need to bring a console with us to one of these conferences.
Dude, everybody would be in our room playing. Yeah. Or just bring it into the conference. But yeah, that and then I really enjoyed like first-person shooter stuff, like
GoldenEye?
Call of Duty. Oh, yeah. Yeah, GoldenEye for sure. But Call of Duty, like on newer consoles, right? Like PS3.
I always think when you're talking GoldenEye,
Xbox 360.
The real question is, would you play as Jaws or Oddjob?
Because
every character in that game is exactly the same height, except Oddjob, who's a little short.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to hit. And then Jaws, who's really tall, so it's super easy to hit.
Yeah.
Remember that hat being deadly?
Yeah, and he could throw his hat too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think overall, like when I was in high school and stuff, I really enjoyed playing Call of Duty and like Halo and stuff like that.
COD,
yeah, sure.
Get that COD.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know, a computer game I really loved, actually, was, because when you said COD, it made me think of it, Command & Conquer.
was Command and Conquer.
Command and Conquer is like this war type game where you you create soldiers, you create your battles ground station, like vehicles, all kinds of stuff you could start making. Like you and you mine things, like you mine for gold or whatever the heck it is, you know, in that game. And then you have the funds to be able to make these things. And then there's an enemy that you're either going to go encroach on them or they're going to encroach on you, and you got to take each other out. And it was a really fun game. And there's several versions of it that came out, but it was a PC only thing. So yeah, it's cool.
Sweet. So I'd be curious, do you have other conferences you're planning on attending this year or have lined up?
I'm excited to go back to NextConf. I want to go to Magnolia one year. It's been really fun. Like,
where's Magnolia at? I've heard of that one.
I wanted to go last year. I didn't go. The year before that was really good, too. It's only a few years old, though, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I think it started, like, when Render started.
Yeah.
I think it's in
Mississippi.
Georgia. No, Mississippi. Yeah, I knew it was south.
Oh, cool.
Yep.
Sweet. We should go to that. We're pretty close.
Yeah, it'd be fun. When is it?
October.
Okay. Well, hopefully it doesn't land on open...
Oh, All Things Open.
All Things Open, yeah.
Yeah, I'll definitely be at All Things Open.
Because that's right next to you, yeah.
Yeah, across the street from my condo.
Right, I want to go to that. That looks pretty cool.
Yeah, you should talk about that one since that's your stomping grounds. Yeah. What's cool about that conference?
All Things Open is massive. So, like, every discipline of tech is there. Like, distributed system stuff.
Not just us JavaScript kids.
No. Yeah, no, it's just, like, every kind of tech person you could think of is there. It's pretty cool.
So, I was like, Raleigh. Good place to be for tech.
Yeah, it's a huge tech scene. People don't realize RTP is the biggest research park in America. So
RTP,
Research Triangle Park. It's kind of like Silicon Valley. Just tons and tons of office space.
Yeah, I have a cousin in Raleigh, and I'd heard this a couple of years ago that it's actually like one of the more legit tech hubs in the country, and that's always stuck in my head as a place I need to check out.
Yeah, because there's just tons of companies there. And then really good colleges. So they've like NC State, Duke, and UNC all next to each other. So it's just, like a big pipeline there too. And then like Epic Games is there. So there's like a video game kind of hub. Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah. Apple just built a building there. So they're about to start hiring like crazy, or already have. But I think for like AI stuff, they're about to start ramping up from what I heard.
Yeah, they're way behind. Have you messed around with AI much?
No, I've done like some of the Vercel kind of starter projects and tutorials, like calling OpenAI APIs and stuff. But
do you use ChatGPT at all?
Yeah, I use it all the time.
So I'll consider that using AI then. Like to me, just
I use it every day.
So here's a stat for you guys. I read this the other day. 58% of people have heard of ChatGPT.
Yep.
14% of people have used ChatGPT.
That's it.
Yeah.
And it's all the tech people.
It's a lot of tech people and just people who are interested in, you know, new things, you know. So even using ChatGPT itself at all puts you way ahead of the curve.
And paying for it, you're like top 1%.
So what do you use it for?
ChatGPT, I'll get it to like spot check things. Sometimes I'll write a letter or I'll like write some messages for work and I'm like, how can I say this?
It could be better, right?
Yeah, either in a more friendly way or I'm just throwing stuff at the wall. A lot of times I don't listen to what it says, but I'll ask it for criticism on things.
A lot of times I ask it to summarize things a lot. Like I'll give it just like a whole article. I'll just copy paste like an entire article and just say, write me a one paragraph summary. It's it's really good at this. Like, dude, I use it for the newsletter, yes, actually.
No, I know. I'm finding it funny because I was just thinking how I probably send you like a very lengthy email and then you take it and you just you say, summarize this for me so I don't have to read all Scott's email.
Well, yeah, that's the joke is that people will write a bullet point list, have ChatGPT turn into an email.
And then somebody takes the email, it and turn it back into a bullet list.
That's incredible.
So silly.
That's funny.
Then I've also been using like Tab9 and then Copilot pretty much since they came out.
Yeah.
Tab9 being another AI code completion tool.
Correct. And then I'm also on the beta for the Copilot chat.
That's interesting. I haven't used that one yet. I've watched Roselle use it, though, a little bit. She's a developer advocate at GitHub and does a lot of Copilot stuff. That's where you have a chat embedded in your code, basically. Mm-hmm. So I'm copy-pasting code and then throwing it into ChatGPT all the time. So it seems kind of silly that I'm not using Copilot chat.
It's pretty great for... Like, the use case I see all the time is, like, I'm writing some React code or something like that. There's a component, and I'm like, hey, just go, like, write me the basic integration test suite for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tests are pretty great.
Yeah, and it's really good at it. Yeah, I love it for that.
An interesting use case I found, this is probably not relevant to you, more relevant to like DevRels, is I'll write something if I want to create a bunch of example apps. You know, a lot of times DevRels will need to create like a React example and a Vue example and a Svelte example. So I'll write the React example and then I'll just give it that and I'll say, write this in Vue. And it'll take the exact code and then write it in Vue. And it just works, like, out of the box. Copy-paste is incredible.
Super dope.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. I love ChatGPT. That's why I call him.
Homie GPT.
Yeah. Homie GPT. Yeah.
It is the homie. Awesome, man. Well, won't you let our listeners know where they could find you on the internets and where they can get in touch with you? If you're someone who wants to be got in touch with.
Yeah.
Ryan_Magoon on Twitter.
Awesome.
That'd be the main one.
Cool, yeah. Well, thank you so much. This is a really interesting conversation. Got a lot of great topics in here. Yeah. And yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was fun. Appreciate it. All right, y'all. See you in the next one. Peace.